And now, more tips with your host, Rebecca, on lifestyle improvement.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and is not to be interpreted as medical advice. Hello and welcome to our program, Lifestyle Improvement. Today we have joining us from Kentucky, Dr. Benjamin Mast. Dr. Mast is a licensed clinical psychologist and professor of psychology and brain sciences and geriatric medicine at the University of Louisville. He is also an elder at the Sojourn Community Church in Louisville and the author of the book, Second Forgetting, Remembering the Power of the Gospel During Alzheimer's Disease. Second Forgetting is a book that touches upon very personal stories, and he works on letting us understand the medical and also the spiritual side of Alzheimer's. We are very pleased to have Dr. Mast with us today. Hello, Dr. Mast. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Thank you for joining us. First of all, I would like you to give us just a quick idea. What brought you to the place where you decided to write this book?
So, as you indicated in your introduction, I'm a psychologist who works with older people, both on the academic side, but also in the clinic. And I've been working with people who have Alzheimer's and other types of dementia for many years, and just felt a real need, both medically and spiritually, to address the lives of people with Alzheimer's disease and their families. I've met many people over the years who, when they get the diagnosis, are just devastated because it's such a painful illness emotionally and spiritually. And I wanted to step into that, to be able to write a book that is essentially a guide for walking through the years of living with Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And you definitely did an excellent job. As I looked at your book, you really did go in through not just a summary, but really did touch upon both the medical and the spiritual side of the disease. So tell us a little bit more about the medical side of Alzheimer's.
So Alzheimer's disease is a progressive neurological condition, meaning it's a disease of the brain. And basically the underlying process in the brain is there are two abnormal changes that happen in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. We call them amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. And essentially, these are microscopic changes that damage the brain. And they start in areas of the brain that are responsible for memory. And they eventually spread throughout the brain, affecting people's judgment, their personality, and other aspects of their functioning. It's one of the more difficult diagnoses in our world today because it is progressive. So it continues to get worse. Mm-hmm. And the longer that people live with it, the more it seems to take away of their ability and their ability to live functionally independent lives. There's currently no cure for Alzheimer's disease. There's quite a bit of research happening, but we haven't found one yet. And so it gives you a little bit about what the disease is about, but also why people are so afraid of it.
Why is it so hard to diagnose Alzheimer's early on?
One of the reasons why it's hard to diagnose early on is it comes on very gradually. And those underlying brain changes, the plaques and tangles that we talk about, the current thinking in terms of the scientific research is that those changes are affecting the brain years before people start to forget. And so there is a quiet period when essentially Alzheimer's is starting to affect the brain, but it hasn't interfered with their ability to function well. And slowly, as those changes accumulate in the brain, people function worse and worse. And eventually it hits a point where families and maybe even the person with Alzheimer's starts to notice. So when I talk with families and people who are facing a diagnosis about when they started to notice the changes, it's not uncommon for them to disagree as to when it began. Some people say a year ago, some people say months, some people say, oh, I think it's actually been 5 years now that I think about it. And it isn't as if one day you're doing just fine and the next day you wake up and you're having significant problems with your memory. That's not the pattern that Alzheimer's follows. It's very gradual and it's almost imperceptible in its earliest stages. And so people have different points in which they finally start to notice that something's going on.
I see. And you do mention memory is filled with mystery. What do you mean with that?
Well, when I say memory is filled with mystery, there are a lot of different elements to it. First, it is amazing how the brain works, even to start with, that we remember anything. So there is a process that has to happen in the brain to encode or store any memories that we have. And we find that we forget some things and we remember others very well, even in a normal functioning brain. And sometimes we walk into a room and we smell a particular smell and it makes us think of something that happened 30 years ago. And so there are good reasons why that would happen, but the everyday experience of memory is a little bit mysterious, even in a normal brain. When we start to look at brains of people with Alzheimer's disease and their memories, the mysterious aspect comes in then again with why do they remember some things and forget others? And a key part of this is there are different aspects of our memory. So somebody with Alzheimer's disease might forget things that happened earlier this morning, but they can remember things that happened 20 years ago, like seemingly like they were yesterday. And there are different things that prompt those memories, and they seem for some people who are living with somebody with Alzheimer's disease to come out of nowhere. And so what we need to do when we start to explore how to have more compassionate, individualized care is to better understand how we can tap into those memories. As I said, introduction to memory problems in Alzheimer's disease, those plaques and tangles start in a particular area of the brain we call the medial temporal lobes and the hippocampus. Without going into a lot of detail on those structures, those are aspects of the brain that store memories that can be retrieved later. So for you or I to remember what we talked about today, that area of the brain has to store that memory so we can retrieve it later and then talk about what happened. It's like putting a file in a file cabinet or saving a file onto the hard drive of your computer. That process in Alzheimer's disease is disrupted early on so that people have most difficulty with recent memory, things that happened today, last week, remembering appointments, conversations, new people that they've met, remembering their names. But there's a whole other aspect of memory that we don't talk about very much in Alzheimer's disease, but which is relatively stronger in comparison to the recent memory. So people retain a fairly good memory for their long-term personal story. We'd call it their autobiographical memory. So they can tell you about what life was like in their 20s and 30s, maybe even into their 40s and 50s. They can tell you their story, and many times they enjoy doing so. There are other aspects of our memory as well, memory for habits, things that we've done so many times, it's as if there are well-worn grooves in the brain for those particular activities. When we say that something is like riding a bike, that's an example of procedural or habit-based memory. And these are things that are relatively resilient, at least in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. And they're things that we can really draw upon if we want to better connect with people with Alzheimer's disease and from a spiritual perspective to think about how to minister to their needs. If you want to make somebody with Alzheimer's really uncomfortable, you can ask them about recent things that have happened. But if you want to help them feel more comfort and more at ease in conversation with you, talk about areas that they know something about and something that parts of their story that they know well. It's a simple way that we can interact with people in a different way that gives them a greater sense of comfort and peace and even some confidence that they can enter into these conversations.
Absolutely. So if you would have one gem that you would want the listeners to remember from our conversation today, would it be that? Would it be to communicate at the memory level that they can still feel comfortable with?
Yeah, I would add with that, try not to start your conversations with the three words, "Do you remember?" It is akin to asking somebody who has a lot of trouble with their vision if they like the scenery or if they like what you're wearing. You're basically going at where they have the most difficulty. So talk with people about their stories, allow them to tell you what they remember, and show some patience and grace when they have some confusion about it or if they repeat themselves. So yeah, that is a good take-home point. So meet them where they're at, not where they used to be.
This is your host, Rebecca, and now we will take a short break, and we will be right back with more ideas on lifestyle improvement.
A unique and specialized approach to spinal care what you will find in the Advanced Spinal Care Clinic in Graham, Washington. Here's Dr. Craig Lipinski explaining why Nuka Care is unlike any other treatment.
Our goal is that we're making a specialized correction to the skull, the atlas, and the neck of each individual that is custom made or custom and specific created to get them healthy and then have them stay that way.
One of only 23 board certified Nuka practitioners in the world, Dr. Craig Lipinski offers you care that can significantly impact your health in positive ways.
This week we've seen somebody in here who's had a 50-point drop in blood pressure by having the skull, atlas, and neck corrected to a proper position.
To find out more about how Nuka Care can change your life, visit www.nuccawashington.com or call 253-445-8181.
Right, that's beautifully said. Meet them where they are, not where they used to be. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So the title of your book is called Second Forgetting, which is a very interesting title. When I first looked at it, I really had to go back into your book and kind of get an idea, because it kind of goes to a different place that's probably not as expected. Talk to me a little bit about that title.
Yeah, so to understand the second forgetting, which I'll get to in a moment, you have to understand the first. And the first forgetting is the progression of memory changes that we've been talking about. So as people move into the stages of Alzheimer's disease, they start to experience what I'm calling for these purposes the first forgetting. The forgetting of recent things, the new learning that becomes increasingly difficult due to neurological damage to the brain. The second forgetting is something that is understood more in a faith context. One of the things that was really interesting for me as I thought about how do we integrate faith with Alzheimer's disease care, and especially in thinking about the biblical context, is the number of times that God calls his people to remember him. And as a person who studies and interacts with people with Alzheimer's disease, I found that call fascinating. Mm-hmm. So here's a call to remember among a people who are extremely prone to forget. But what's really interesting when you look at the broad span of Bible stories is God's people have been prone to forget for many generations, and God continually is calling them back to remember him, to remember his faithfulness, and that he's with them in the present, regardless of what difficulties they're going through, and that he promises a brighter future for them. So the second forgetting, in a sense, is our tendency to forget the faithfulness, presence, and promises of God. And it applies to people with Alzheimer's disease. It applies to people who take care of them, who are overwhelmed by the burden of care, overwhelmed by what might happen in the future. But it also applies to all of us, whether it's Alzheimer's care or whether it is an overly busy day or the blow up that happened this morning. We can be fine and feeling at peace 1 minute, and then something happens and it's as if we forget all the goodness and trust that we had earlier that day. So one thing that happens as people move into Alzheimer's disease, particularly people of faith, and I wrote this book obviously for a Christian audience, drawing on some of the biblical themes of remembering, is that when they hear the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, they know how difficult it can be. They know it isn't going to get better, at least from a neurological standpoint. They know there's no cure, and they become overwhelmed. And even people who took great comfort in their faith start to forget that God has promised to be with them, even in the midst of their suffering. And so the book is about, in the context of a disease of very severe forgetting, how can we help people remember God? How can we help them remember their faith and find comfort and peace there? And also, how can we help their churches and their communities of faith to remember them and keep them as a valued member of their faith community?
And that is a very important point, because as caregivers, you really need as much support as you can get in order to take care of those that you love that are going through this journey, and the church being a very important part of this. So when you are working with your families, and as you are, you just shared relating some of what the faith part of this is, in the sense of A lot of people that you're working with may have or may not have a faith in God.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you put that into perspective?
One of the things that I want to do when I'm starting to meet with a family or somebody with Alzheimer's disease is I want to understand who they are and what their history is and where they're coming from. Part of this is a faith-based perspective on Alzheimer's care, but it's also fits within what we would call person-centered care for people with Alzheimer's disease. That is, recognizing that the person sitting in front of me is not just a collection of deficits or a diagnosis. They're not just an Alzheimer's sufferer. They are a person who deserves honor and respect and value, and they have a long history. And so for me to understand how we might try to plan more individualized care, I have to understand who that person is. And so for those people who have a Christian faith or have found comfort in the biblical stories and promises, I know that that's a point of connection for them. But it doesn't mean that if somebody doesn't have that same faith that I can't find ways to work with them. Because the point that I want to make is, when you are trying to figure out how to work with somebody with Alzheimer's and their family, how can you improve their quality of life and give them as good of years as they can have, you have to start with who they are and what's important to them. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to appreciate their values. Who's important? What's important? If they had their choice, how would they choose to spend their time? And that's my starting point. And in the context that I work here a little bit in the Bible Belt, that is a key part of people's story. And so it's a common point of connection to talk about their faith and their membership in their church and faith community. And it's a real source of comfort for people to say, there's a lot changing in my life. There's a lot happening that's going to be quite different, but here's one constant that I can hold on to. And we don't have many of those for people with Alzheimer's disease. So when we can step into it, it's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. And I actually was going to ask, what are some common things that you find besides possibly their faith, as you mentioned, that mm-hmm. you may find in common from all of your patients that are those things that still stand as most important to them?
One of the things that we see as people move into Alzheimer's disease is they start to feel more isolated from other people. And there's a tendency to want to have, in most cases, again, people are different, to have those people who they love, their family, their close friends near them. And one of the things that I think is important to talk with families and friends about is, even when that person progresses to a point where maybe they don't remember your visits or remember the time that you came and did something kind for them, maybe even they'll forget your name when you visit on occasion, it doesn't mean that that visit and that time that you spent with them doesn't matter. Mm. They can be confused about some things, but they can remember how you made them feel. Mm. And so continuing to step in, the relational aspect of Alzheimer's care is incredibly important, but it's also one of the pieces that's most strained, especially for the caregivers. Because now you've moved from a relationship as a spouse or an adult child or a friend or a sibling, and the old relationship that you have is now merged with a new relationship where you're now doing things for them that they used to be able to do on your own. And that's physically tiring, as you know. It's also emotionally tiring. It isn't just that caregiving is difficult because you have so much to do, although that is certainly part of it. It's also difficult because there's a grieving process that many people are going through because you've already lost some things with the person. They're still alive, they're still with you, but you lose aspects of the relationship, and there's a grieving process that's a part of that. And so it's a real physical and emotional load. And as you said earlier, you know, we don't want people to go at it alone. It's really a recipe for a lot of burnout, a lot of burden, and even depression.
Absolutely. And, you know, you said something that they remember how you make them feel. Mm-hmm. That is extremely powerful both directions, because I think as caregivers, you have to go through that journey together with them. And mm-hmm. you have to deal with your own feelings about it, like you mentioned.
Absolutely.
You know, and that can be a combination of a variety of things. Some people may be dealing with, you know, unresolved issues from childhood. And yes. you still have to put it all into context and come in there and try to make that person feel as loved and as cared for as possible, correct?
Yes. And absolutely, that is, it's one of those things where that is our task, is to do as much as we can, to love them as well as we can. But we also realize that we're living with our own limitations. There's only so much we can each individually take. Even the most patient among us eventually loses their patience. And I think this is where the concept of grace is really important. There's so much that we can do, and we won't always succeed. We could try to provide the best care that we can, but sometime we'll do something that maybe isn't the best care that we could offer. And this, again, is a place where we have to show ourselves some compassion. So do the best you can, but know that you're limited. Everybody is. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening and you feel like there are days where I just can't provide the best care, I feel like I can't really get past some of my frustration or my guilt, know that you're not alone. That's a very common experience, and it's understandable. You're carrying a lot.
Right. And learning to forgive, maybe not just past issues that you may have had with this person because they're so vulnerable now and need you so much, but learning to forgive yourself when maybe you do have those days that are not as successful as some others, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Forgiving yourself is key. You've got to move on. Each day has enough troubles of its own.
It's so true. So tell me about a little bit more concerning some of the things that you would tell caregivers as far as advice in order for them to be able to manage the load or the responsibility of caring for somebody with Alzheimer's and still be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah, that's a really challenging balance. And I think different caregivers find their way differently. I think the starting point, which I've already mentioned, but it bears repeating, is don't try to do it alone. So you need some physical help in terms of the care, whether it is somebody who helps do things around your house, whether it is somebody who comes to sit with the person with Alzheimer's disease while you go run errands or actually think about going to do something that you enjoy so you can recharge. But you also need somebody who will emotionally support you. One thing I recommend to caregivers is to think about whether there is at least one person that they feel like they can really trust, who they can share their heart with and talk about the difficulties that they're facing and how hard it is. I think one of the big deficits we have in caring for caregivers is the people who try to care for caregivers don't spend enough time just listening. Mm. And they need to listen to caregivers to hear, allow them time and space to talk about what it's like for them, what are the unique challenges of it. And I think many caregivers feel like unless you've walked through this, you really don't know why this is as difficult as it is. Mm-hmm. In writing Second Forgetting, one of the things that I did was just to spend time interviewing families affected by Alzheimer's disease. And that was one of the common themes that came up. They just longed for somebody in their life and for some of these men and women, someone from the church, to stay present with them, to journey with them, and to just listen to what's going on without trying to offer quick fixes, you know, to say, well, this is temporary. Well, this isn't that bad. Or I did this, you should do this. Really, we need to listen. And then the next step is to listen a bit more, to journey along with people. Once you do that, you better understand what's going on and you better understand how you can step in. So for caregivers, it takes a bit of assertiveness to step out and try to identify that person. And again, you want to see if it's somebody that you can trust, but basically start to share a bit about what's going on and not journey alone.
And you talk about caregivers being the hidden victims of dementia. What do you mean with that?
Well, when somebody shows up at their doctor's office or healthcare professional's office presenting with symptoms of dementia or Alzheimer's disease, oftentimes, we start to do the evaluation. Maybe they get their history and physical. Maybe they get some labs run to rule out other problems, maybe even some cognitive testing. And we've started to focus all of our attention on the person who's developing the symptoms. And that is appropriate at some level. They are clearly the identified patient. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't also spend time trying to address the needs of the people who are going to care for that person who has Alzheimer's disease. And sometimes we get so focused on making a diagnosis or on caring for the person with dementia that we neglect the heavy burden that the person who is the caregiver is carrying. Mm-hmm. And so for many years, at least in the research and clinical literature, there wasn't much attention paid to caregivers. That's improving, but we still have to be mindful that in each individual encounter, we do the person with dementia and the caregiver a lot of good if we address the caregiver's needs. Because if we haven't done that, they can't provide optimal care for the person with dementia. I want to be clear, the caregiver as a person matters, and their needs matter, and the care for them matters significantly. We also get the double benefit in that when we provide good care for caregivers, they can provide good care to others. I heard it said recently in a talk, how can caregivers actually provide good person-centered care for the person with dementia if they don't feel like they've been cared for or that they're valued? I think it's a really key point that we often miss.
Thank you so much for joining us today for part one of our interview with Dr. Benjamin Mast, author of the book, Second Forgetting.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and it's not to be interpreted as medical advice.
If you would like to advertise with us, please give us a call at 877-957-7387, extension 101. That again is 877-957-7387, extension 101. Or send us an email to producer@lifestyleimprovement.com. That again is producer@lifestyleimprovement.com. Don't forget to tune in again next Sunday morning from 7:30 to 8 for part 2 of our interview with Dr. Benjamin Mast.